Blog Talk Radio.
It's 3 p.m., and I have a question for you. Do you know where your politicians are? Everything is political in your life, from the moment you're born to the moment you die. And when a politician tells you that's not true, look in your pocket. You'll find their hand in it. Everything is political. We will be talking to those politicians that are working for you and talking about those politicians that are working against you. Just because they're a Democrat, or just because they're a Republican, and you voted that way your entire life, maybe you were wrong. Because everybody is not what they seem to be. However, there are a few out there who are working for your benefit, and we are going to bring them to you. We're going to let you hear them. We're going to ask them questions. We're going to let you ask them questions. And we're going to be discussing education system, the military, science, music, sports, oh, and health care. Do you have it? Do you need it? Are your 26-year-olds still on the family health care plan? Or, as the regressive party says, Obamacare? We will bring you what you need to know, because this is the last word. And everything, from the cities, counties, state, nation, the entire world. So sit down and get a pencil, paper, and take this graduate education experience. And we will make sure that you have the last word. My name is Michael Lawson.
Okay, we have a packed show, of course, like every Friday. Something has come up that we have to attend to. Now, this seems to be a major, major problem with Jeannie Thomas. You don't know who Jeannie Thomas is. Jeannie Thomas is the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence. It wasn't me, Thomas. Well, we have a long playlist here, so I'm going to start right away. This was part of Morning Joe this morning.
Warsaw will be our guest this morning ahead of President Biden's visit to his city, and we'll speak with Admiral James Stavridis and Richard Haass about what was accomplished at those NATO meetings. But first, we want to tell you about some extraordinary reporting out of Washington. NBC News has confirmed that the committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol has obtained text messages that show conservative activist Jeannie Thomas, the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, repeatedly pressing then-Trump White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows to fight to overturn the election. Copies of 29 text messages were obtained by the Washington Post. NBC News has not reviewed those texts. The first message was a link to a video from a far-right conspiracy theorist that claimed Trump watermarked ballots as part of an effort to catch fraud. In the message, she texted, "I hope this is true. Never heard anything like this before, or even a hint of it. Possible?" she asked. She went on to quote a passage that circulated on far-right websites about the, quote, Biden crime family and ballot fraud co-conspirators being arrested and, quote, will be lying in barges off Gitmo to face, living in barges off Gitmo to face military tribunals for sedition. My God. According to the Post, on November 6th, she followed up, encouraging Mark Meadows, quote, do not concede. It takes time for the army who is gathering for his back. This is crazy. On November 10th, after news organizations had declared Joe Biden the projected winner, Thomas reportedly texted Meadows, help this great president stand firm, Mark. You are the leader with him who is standing for America's constitutional governance at the precipice. The majority knows Biden and the left is attempting the greatest heist of our history. And really, painfully, there is much more.
Yeah, this is really extraordinary stuff from Bob Woodward and Bob Costa. The Post reports Thomas also pushed Meadows to work closely with Sidney Powell, one of the lawyers who promoted conspiracy theories to help Trump overturn the election. Even when Donald Trump began to distance himself from Powell, Thomas stood by her, reportedly texting Mark Meadows on November 13th, quote, don't let her and your assets be marginalized. Instead, help her be the lead and the face. The next day, Thomas sent Meadows a text that she said was from Congressman Louie Gohmert's chief of staff, writing this, quote, the most important thing you can realize right now is that there are no rules in war. This war is psychological. PSYOP, she wrote. In a November 24th message to Thomas, the Post says Meadows responded this way, quote, this is a fight of good versus evil. Evil always looks like the victor until the King of Kings triumphs. Do not grow weary in well-doing. The fight continues. I have staked my career on it. That's from Mark Meadows back to Ginny Thomas. Thomas responds this way. Thank you. Needed that. This plus a conversation with my best friend just now. I will try to keep holding on. America is worth it. It's unclear who exactly Thomas was referring to as her best friend, but previous reports say Thomas and her husband refer to each other in that regard and have done so publicly. Justice Thomas is not directly referenced in any of the messages, and Mrs. Thomas has said in the past she and her husband are not involved in each other's work. However, Clarence Thomas was the only justice, we'll remind you, who voted against the National Archives handing over President Trump's presidential records, which include these text messages, to the January 6th committee. And he dissented when the Supreme Court rejected Trump's bogus election challenges. NBC News has reached out to the attorney for Mark Meadows and to Ginny Thomas for comments. So, Joe, a lot to digest there. Obviously, the key question is, did Ginny Thomas speak for or represent the thinking of Justice Clarence Thomas, who made those decisions, who recused himself in that other case? But this is true, forgive me, quack stuff that she's pushing out there and suggesting that Sidney Powell, perhaps the lead quack, run this operation.
Well, yeah, and I must say, spending a good deal of my adult life in the conservative community in Washington, D.C., this is one of the most disturbing things I've read. I can't believe I'm saying this through the entire Trump presidency and what we found out after the Trump presidency for three reasons. First of all, spouses do their own work. They can do whatever they want to do. Clarence Thomas does not tell his wife what to do and vice versa. We can make that assumption. But Ginny Thomas on her own has been a pillar of Washington, D.C.'s conservative community. She's revered. She's celebrated. The who's who of Washington, D.C., looks upon this woman as a leader of the conservative movement. It tells you how deeply corrupted and intellectually flawed that movement became through the Trump years. Ginny Thomas, I must say on a personal note, when I knew her serving in the House of Representatives, she was always an apologist for the Republican establishment. She always carried the water for the Republican establishment, and she has maintained those ties throughout her time in Washington, D.C. So Ginny Thomas is a representative of where the Republican Party has gone over the past 25, 30 years. That's frightening enough, reading these text messages. Secondly, you have the chief of staff of the President of the United States actually summoning the name of Jesus Christ. Think about the sickness of this. He summons the name of Jesus Christ for his help in overturning American democracy. Now, you could call it what you want to call it, but if you're trying to throw out a presidential election because you lost, that's overthrowing American democracy. And he says he will make it the fight of his life with the help of Jesus Christ to overturn American democracy. Okay, so see, here's the thing about Mark when he was trying to undermine American democracy. He said, this is a fight of good versus evil. But as a friend of mine said after reading the story last night, he's right. It was a fight between good and evil. He just got the jerseys mixed up. He was not on the side of good, using Jesus Christ's name to spread lies, to spread conspiracy theories. I'm telling you, that's a level of sickness I never thought I would see from my old party. And the third thing, that is, yes, it is shocking about this, that Clarence Thomas, when he had a case that came before him that he knew his wife would be associated with, didn't recuse himself. He was the lone dissenter to stop these text messages from coming out. And we've been told, by the way, that Clarence Thomas is in good health, that he's going to be fine, that he's recovered from treatment, and we are very grateful for that, and we look forward to him coming back on the court sometime very soon. What he did here, shocking. Any judge, you know what I said before where he said the work of spouses can be separated out and should be separated out. They're independent actors, except when they're not. And here, this is where their work comes together. And I will say, Jonathan Lemire, the fact that Clarence Thomas did not recuse himself, the fact that the president's chief of staff, after a presidential election that everybody knows he lost, including Mark Meadows. Everybody knows he lost, including Mark Meadows. He says he's going to make it the fight of his life with the help of Jesus Christ, the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, to overturn American democracy. This is really, really sick stuff. And it really does show just the depths to which these people were willing to go to try to attack American democracy and throw out what Donald Trump's own people said was the cleanest presidential election in American history.
Yeah, you'd think we'd be beyond surprised at this point, but this was a jaw-dropping story when it broke last night. And a lot of Democrats that I talked to, aides to members of Congress, suggested, like, could this be something where Clarence Thomas be impeached, or at least face an inquiry about this? There's only been one Supreme Court justice ever impeached before in the history of the United States. We should mention Thomas still hospitalized for an infection. There is belief that he will recover, the Supreme Court says, but it's not clear when he will resume his duties physically on the bench. But this is something also we should remember, that Mark Meadows, there's a criminal referral for Mark Meadows from the January 6th committee because of his refusal to cooperate with that investigation. So a lot of people looking at the Department of Justice to see where that could go. But this shows in such stark detail the efforts to overturn the election and the delusion that had gripped the Trump White House and some of its closest allies to try to compare this effort to the work of Jesus Christ and to call it the work of good versus evil, and to show that it will stop at nothing. These texts all come from the window right after the election, and we know that the fever only intensified within the West Wing as Trump, so many staffers left, and Trump was only left there with his loyalists, and including Rudy Giuliani, Sidney Powell, who kind of came in and out of favor, and Mark Meadows was there throughout, and they stopped at nothing in efforts to try to overturn this election. We should also mention Ginni Thomas has admitted she was at President Trump's rally on the Ellipse the morning of January 6th. She said she did not go on to the Capitol ahead of the riot, but she was right there in every possible effort to overturn this election, the wife of a sitting Supreme Court justice.
Yeah, let me just say, Democrats talking about impeachment, or are people talking about crimes coming out of this, just take a deep breath. What we've learned is justice will not be served when it comes to Donald Trump. It just won't. I don't know why. I don't know why the Justice Department won't walk through that door and actually hold him accountable. I don't know what happened in Manhattan. I sure know that the prosecutors, and we didn't report about this because, well, we've got a war going on. We're on the verge of World War III, but you have a prosecutor who quit the case up in Manhattan because he said what we all know. We all know this, too. Donald Trump's guilty of multiple crimes. Now, if you're out there writing columns saying that this is a witch hunt, you don't know Donald Trump. Donald Trump hyperinflated the value of his assets his entire life. He lied to banks about it. It is the testimony. He lied to everybody about it. Has long been the opinion of everybody that's ever known him or been around him. And it seems that the facts bear that out. Certainly the prosecutor thought that, but guess what? Once again, Donald Trump escapes justice. So if you're sitting here reading this story thinking that actually justice will be served against these people who tried to overthrow American democracy, we found out that this Justice Department is not interested in doing that. We found out Merrick Garland's not interested in serving up justice because somebody somewhere might think, oh my God, there's a political angle to this. Are you kidding me? This after that guy that's on the screen right now spent 4 years trying to break down the wall between the White House and the Justice Department, the White House and the FBI, the White House and the intel services. And now we have an attorney general that won't even bring charges when crimes are committed. We have a DA in Manhattan that won't even bring charges when his own prosecutors who've been on this case a long time said he's committed multiple crimes. It's just not going to happen. In this case, Mika, it's not going to happen either. And that's all a very long prelude to say this. Even if no charges are ever brought, even if there's no disciplinary actions ever taken in this case, this Woodward story and Costa story, these texts, these exchanges serve as the most damning indictment against the Trump White House that we have seen so far. And Mark Meadows makes it very clear that he is going to use the shield of Jesus Christ. Oh, what a righteous man to overturn American democracy. And prosecutors, I don't know if intent still matters at the Justice Department, but if it does, he says in his text that the mission of his life will be overturning a fair and free democratic American election. Let that sink in for a second, guys, gals, and tell me whether there's intent there to subvert American democracy. Well, we know how this story's going to end. Everybody's going to walk. The bad guys always get away in the Trump administration. They will here as well. It's unfortunately, the whole American belief that no man is above the law, that doesn't apply to Donald Trump. We don't know why. It just doesn't. But again, this story in and of itself, Mika, yeah, these texts, they indict all of them as un-American, unpatriotic seditioners.
This morning from the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas sent to former Trump Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, urging the White House to fight the results of the 2020 election and deploying conspiracy theories to do so. In a moment, we will speak with Bob Woodward, who broke the story. But first, NBC News senior Capitol Hill correspondent Garrett Hake has the details. Garrett, good morning.
Hey, Willie, good morning to you. Yeah, these text messages were among thousands Mark Meadows turned over to the January 6th committee late last year, according to a person familiar. And according to the Washington Post, they show the wife of a sitting Supreme Court justice leaning hard on then-President Trump's top aide to do everything he could to overturn the election results.
In text messages obtained by the January 6th committee and reviewed by the Washington Post, Jeannie Thomas, the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, repeatedly urges then-Trump Chief of Staff Mark Meadows to keep fighting the results of the 2020 election. In one text, 1 week after Election Day, she reportedly writes, quote, "Help this great president stand firm, Mark. The majority knows Biden and the left is attempting the greatest heist of our history." In other texts, the Post reports, Mrs. Thomas pushes debunked conspiracy theories about the election. In one, referencing a non-existent, quote, sting operation in 12 battleground states involving watermarked ballots. According to the Post, during that period, a theory about watermarked ballots also circulated among the fringe group QAnon. During the 2 months covered by the text messages, Mr. Trump engaged in multiple legal challenges to the election results and frequently threatened to take them all the way to the nation's top court.
We want the law to be used in a proper manner. So we'll be going to the U.S. Supreme Court.
None of the text messages mentions the court or Clarence Thomas directly, the Post reports. But critics argue the texts present a troubling conflict of interest for Justice Thomas, who was the lone dissent in an 8-1 January Supreme Court ruling forcing Mr. Trump to turn over documents to the January 6th committee. Should Clarence Thomas recuse himself from anything having to do with the 2020 election now?
Absolutely. It's clear that his wife was involved in efforts to try to overturn the election. There's a good possibility that he and his wife spoke about those efforts.
In an interview with the Washington Free Beacon earlier this month, Ginny Thomas said she and her husband stay in separate lanes, adding, quote, Clarence doesn't discuss his work with me, and I don't involve him in my work. She acknowledged in that same interview she attended Trump's January 6th rally, but says she left before he spoke. She also denied a report that she was involved with planning the rally that ended with the violent attack on the nation's capital.
The Supreme Court's internal rules say justices should recuse themselves in cases of conflict of interest, but there's no real enforcement of that. It's purely on the honor system. And Justice Thomas has recused himself in some cases over his lengthy career, but never for anything involving his wife's interests. Really?
NBC's Garrett Hake at the United States Capitol for us this morning. Garrett, thanks so much. Mika?
Well, joining us now, Pulitzer Prize-winning Associate Editor of the Washington Post, Bob Woodward. He is co-author with Robert Costa of the book Peril, and he and Costa broke this story about the text messages. And, wow, I'm not sure where to begin. I guess I'll ask you to choose among two of what I think are the biggest takeaways from it. I mean, is this a story about Ginny Thomas, or is it about a Supreme Court justice potentially being compromised in a decision that he made that he gave absolutely no reason for, and none of the other justices went that way?
Well, we're going to find out. I mean, this is a story that is starting, but what struck Robert Costa and myself is we got access to these text messages. When I walked in here with you, you had a look of wonder that I've, frankly, over the years, never seen on your
face. It's just, but you can't write these text messages and believe in the Constitution. So there's just this massive conflict. And what has happened to this, I think, fairly well-known Republican member of the Republican Party, Ginny Thomas?
Yes, well, she's an activist, and she's entitled to that. She has the First Amendment rights. But here she is playing the role of campaign manager and political consultant for the White House, coming in and talking about things that I mean, there is a self-righteous tone. We're on the moral high road. I mean, Meadows himself says this is a fight of good versus evil.
He's reinforced
the name of Jesus, you know,
oh
King of Kings.
God.
You know, to help in this, I guess you have to call it a crusade that they were on. So tell me about Meadows in this exchange. How do you read his texts? Is he all in with Ginny Thomas? Is clearly all in on, you know, let's just overturn this election. Is he all in on that? Is he humoring her at times?
Mm-hmm.
What is he?
Well, I think sometimes, I mean, White House Chief of Staff, I've written about 15 of them over the years. There's a lot of incoming. And, but it's that one where he says good versus evil. And this is the problem we have in our politics. And people who believe, as you point out, Mika, in the Constitution's very clear. We'll have the election. Then once we have the election, The Constitution and the Electoral Count Act make it crystal clear. It now goes to the Congress to certify the winner. And in this process, it's sacrosanct, it's clear. Yeah. It was Vice President Pence who resisted all of this pressure. But here we have Ginny Thomas not just being part of the pressure campaign, but herself saying, release the Kraken.
I know, the mythological release the Kraken. You know, Sidney Powell, I'm going to call her a wingnut because she was the most extreme, most unhinged. By this time, Donald Trump has decided that Sidney Powell is off the rails, yet Ginny Thomas is still with him.
And yes, Ginny Thomas say, make her the face in the lead of this effort.
Willie.
Yeah, Bob, she actually reaches out to Meadows to say she does not like the disparagement that she's seen from White House officials of Sidney Powell. She's got a thing for Sidney Powell. Who knows what it is? I mean, there's so much to point to there. I would also add that when she watched Ginny Thomas, the infamous RNC press conference with Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani, yes, the one where he was sweating hair dye down his cheek, she wrote to Mark Meadows that she was brought to tears by what Rudy was doing in a good way. She was so moved by his attempt to overturn the election. The key question, though, as you point out, is whether or not Justice Thomas shares any of these feelings, whether he knew about it, whether it affect his decisions to recuse himself or to dissent on the National Archives question. Did you find anything in your reporting, Bob, that showed he shares the views of Ginny Thomas?
We don't know that, and at the same time, the January 6th committee, as demonstrated by these texts, is very aggressive in going after the full story. I think there's going to be a question, do they want to subpoena Ginny Thomas? And that is about as delicate. You can almost hear the air vibrate when you raise that possibility.
How could they not?
On that point, though, she does. There is a text in which she refers to a conversation she had with my best friend.
Right.
How did you read that? Did you read that as a conversation?
He has publicly called her his best friend. And there's an implication there, but
it seems like she's intonating toward him, but we don't know.
Exactly. And as reporters, we want to stick to the story and let's find out here. But there's an audacity in these messages. There is a kind of at the end,
fervor.
She says, America is going to be lost if Biden wins. She attacks Biden and says he's part of the Biden crime family and so forth. I mean, this is what, over the years, we've all seen lots of true believers on the Republican Party, Democratic Party, left and right. But these are the people who stay behind the scenes and run campaigns. They are not out. Negotiating with the White House chief of staff, this is the messaging, the staffing directions, this is the strategy.
And she happens to be married to a Supreme Court justice. Jonathan Lemire has the next question.
Hey, Bob, good to see you again. Jaw-dropping reporting nicely done. Want to get you to weigh in on something we were talking about a little earlier. We talk about Justice Thomas, but also the bind this now puts Chief Justice Roberts in, as he has been so mindful of trying to protect the reputation of the court, trying to keep it above and out of politics, and yet politics has now landed on his doorstep.
Yes, well, I mean, this is a difficulty not just for Roberts, but for the whole court. What is going on here? What is the obligation? And the obligation, happily, is in the Constitution and the laws. And in one of these text messages, believe it or not, she says, well, we should talk to former Nixon aide, Monica Crowley, mm-hmm. and she knows how to deal with things like this. We know what happened to Nixon.
Yeah.
And have we forgotten the lessons of Watergate? What were the lessons of Watergate? Don't tamper with and meddle with our election system. We have a system that is held its ground beautifully over the years, and to have this, to see the passion, the sense of you can only look at this one way, what has happened? I mean, Gene, you've written about this almost every week.
Yeah.
The division in our politics is so great. Mm-hmm. And it's not just on the right, it's on the left, as we know. And so who's going to find a way to turn down the temperature?
Joe, jump in.
Well, and again, let's go back to what Mark Meadows said in his text back. For her, after she sent crazed QAnon conspiracy theories, he said this is a battle of good versus evil. He summoned Jesus Christ's help in overturning American democracy. And you are right. He says this is a fight versus good versus evil. Evil always looks like the victor until the King of Kings triumphs. Do not grow weary in well-doing, the fight continues. I have staked my career on it, Bob. That is, I think, I know a lot of people are focusing on what Jenny Thomas said. For me, though, that Meadows statement, that Meadows text is the most breathtaking because you all, you and Costa masterfully put together the reporting in your book on the lead up to January 6th. But this takes us into the mindset of people inside the Trump White House who actually believe, running the Trump White House, actually believe they were doing Jesus Christ's work by undermining American democracy and keeping in power illegally a want-to-be tyrant. I've got to ask you, in all of your years of reporting on this Trump White House, have you seen anything more shocking than what you uncovered in this story that was published yesterday?
Well, comparing shocks is really a difficult business, particularly having done this for 50 years. But this, see, what the real bend in this is all these texts are after the election. We have a system, we hold the election, okay, now it's over, and as we know, every state, 50 states and the District of Columbia submitted their electors, and that was it. Along comes this lawyer who writes the memo saying, oh, no, there's seven states that have alternative John Eastman. I mean, come on. There were zero, and it was investigated. So at this moment, you have to kind of say we've all been in conflicts and battles. You have to kind of say it's over.
Yeah.
We lost.
Yeah.
The Constitution makes it very clear. Jenny Thomas is saying, no,
it's not
over. This is the end of America.
Yeah.
There is an emotionalism. There is a conviction. And so Joe Biden, as we all know, has the job finding a way to kind of get it down, get us to stop doing this, because this will
destroy us.
Where does it lead?
Joe has one more. Joe.
Sorry.
Well, and I was just going to say, where does it lead? You have a pillar of the conservative community in Washington, D.C., the wife of the Supreme Court Justice, and the chief of staff of the President of the United States, again, working to overthrow a presidential election because they don't like the outcome. That is just absolutely breathtaking. And I'm just curious, Bob, everybody knows you changed the course of history, the arc of American history and American journalism 50 years ago with your Watergate reporting. I am curious, put this in context, everything that you've been reporting on over the past year, put it in context with what you uncovered during Watergate.
Well, but we're going to see, and as in Watergate, it took a couple of years to get to the bottom, and you know, even that was not the bottom when Nixon resigned, because more comes out all of the time. So we're just going to have to be patient here. I always repeat myself, but somebody's got to get this down. So, and to see somebody like Ginny Thomas and Mark Meadows. I mean, Mark Meadows wasn't just a guy in the White House. He was the top aide.
The chief of staff.
He was the chief of staff.
Exactly.
And to take this position after the election. You see, if these texts were before the election, you would say, okay, this is the political,
right.
Insufferable political discourse we live through on a daily
but
basis.
But the election's over, it's decided, the electors have been, you know, the electoral count just has to be certified rubber stamp, that's it. It's done. And so the thing is, these are major figures in the Republican Party, right? And, you know, I mean, Ginny Thomas has been active in the Republican Party, a mainstream, very conservative, but a mainstream Republican figure, as was Mark Meadows, again, very on the conservative side, but they were not fringe people, and yet all of a sudden they're talking like, weird cult members.
What happened? It's not the call. It's the call to action. We can't permit this. We have to save the country. There is, and so what's the to-do list from this? As you pointed out, Mika, Sidney Powell, most extreme, rejected in the end by Trump himself.
Yeah.
And here we have the wife of Clarence Thomas, the justice, saying, you know, make her the lead, make her the face. We're going to continue this fight. And the problem is, in many people's minds now, that fight continues. One of the texts refers, Ginny Thomas says, you know, don't cave to the elites. The 73 million people, those who voted for Trump, are counting on you. We can't take this. We can't lie down for this.
Wow.
And so how do you... Joe Biden has the biggest international catastrophe in decades on his hands. He also has a simultaneously political division in this country that mirrors that. And I've known Biden for almost 50 years. He has a responsibility and an obligation to come up with a plan to deal with Ukraine, most important issue by far. But he's got to come back, because what happens at home matters, and what happens at home is not good now.
Yeah. Joe?
Bob, I want to just underline something that you said in Ginny Thomas's tweet, one of her tweets, and it is so indicative of how the Republican Party plays victim, how they try to play this phony populist game. You have the wife of a Supreme Court justice, one of the most powerful conservative people in Washington, D.C., talking to the chief of staff in the White House, the president of the United States, most powerful person in the world, saying, don't cave to the elites. These two are the elites. They are at the center of power. If anybody's at the center of power, and she's throwing out that victimhood. Isn't that so symbolic? Isn't that so representative of what Republicans have been doing for years? They play victims when they're the ones in most firmly ensconced in power after going to Yale and Stanford. If you look at this, these senators and Princeton and Harvard and on and on and on, it's such a phony populist game.
The evidence is there in these texts, but I think we just have to pull back, or at least I personally as a reporter on this, and say it's not just the right wing. There is a lot of this kind of emotional, there is only one way to look at this from the left. And if we as a country have to face that. Now, Gene, you're disagreeing.
Well, you're getting a skeptical look because, yes, there are extreme voices on the left. I don't think this is an
right or left.
This is an equal balance thing. I don't think this is, I think, because what you saw was the Republican Party, writ large, basically losing its mind, but becoming a Trumpist party and adopting positions that establishment Republicans were horrified by. Very conservative establishment Republicans were horrified by. I don't see something equivalent happening.
Okay, that's absolutely a fair and provable point. And the question is, with Ginny Thomas and Mark Meadows and so forth, are they fringe representatives or do they represent what you're talking about?
Uh-huh.
And I think there's a little of both. And but I just think it would be a mistake to say this is only the Republicans and Trump. But
Joe,
you're absolutely right. They got their president. And
yeah.
Evidence that Robert Costa and I have, Trump is going to run again, and that may change, that may not happen, obviously, but the number 73 million is a big number.
It's a big number.
And a lot of them are there for him, so that's different. But now Biden, I'm going back to this, Biden has that on his shoulders in a very important way for this country.
Joe?
But Gene, I just want to follow up with you, Gene.
Yeah.
You know, over the last year or two, I have been critical of the left because they're going for 6.6 Build Back Better price tags instead of a 3.1. All right, we're talking about fiscal matters, okay? So that's on the left. Let's talk about on the right. And by the way, even if you want to go to the social issues, the 0.003% of the population that's transgender, that people say they now want to be friends with Vladimir Putin and Orban because of 0.003% of the population. Okay, so that's the left. That makes conservatives so crazy they start moving to Hungary and worshiping Orban and Putin. On the right, though, Gene, you're absolutely right. We have, by the way, this is Donald Trump has the highest approval rating in that Republican Party. You have Ginny Thomas and the then chief of staff of the White House. What are they talking about? Are they talking about fiscal issues? Are they talking about social issues that can be debated? No, they're talking about overthrowing a duly elected president of the United States, arresting him, arresting his family, putting them on a barge to stand trial off of Guantanamo Bay. There is, that is a false equivalency. And while there are progressives, that on certain policy issues are not mainstream, with the rest of the American people. I do not see leaders of the Democratic Party saying Biden crime family and ballot fraud co-conspirators elected are going to be put on a barge. Bureaucrats, social media censorship mongers, mainstream media reporters are being arrested and detained for ballot fraud right now, and over the coming days, says the wife of a Supreme Court justice to the chief of staff of a Republican president who is trying to defraud the American people and steal the presidency, and will be living in barges off Gitmo to face military tribunals for sedition. If there is a parallel with any Democratic leader in Washington, D.C., let me know right now.
I mean, what's so great to hear is your passion, Joe. And,
no, it's the truth. I said that very quietly. It's the truth.
If I could just go back to one more of the Ginni Thomas text. Yeah. She quoted, there are no rules in war.
Uh-huh.
And it's clear from this, from these texts and the world we're living in, that people on both sides, maybe large portions on both sides, look at politics as war. It isn't war. It shouldn't be war. Go back to the Nixon period. Go back to the George W. Bush period. And there were differences, and there was a
But the Democrats are following the rules, Bob. They are. There's nobody saying there's no rules, and we just put them on barges and put them on Guantanamo. It's war, and the stakes are high.
Okay, but
that's
the problem.
That's what some people are saying, right?
Yes.
There are people on the left who believe it's war.
The point I'm trying to make is there are people on the left and the right who think we're in some sort of war, a survival war.
A survival war. Can you believe that the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court has a wife that would even think about doing something so absurd and so out in the open? Couldn't keep it secret? No, because they don't give a shit. They don't give a damn. And believe me, I believe that Thomas was always a token. Well, that's what broke today. And I have to continue it first. We have a mea culpa coming on that's going to talk about how this guy got involved and all, how he was. The thing I've been saying before, this has all been a setup. He has been part of the Russian invasion of Ukraine and destroying NATO since he got there, because that's why he was able to get there, because he told the Russians, Putin, that he would help them get there so they can invade Ukraine and get Ukraine back. Let's listen to this. This is the mea culpa, which is going to go right into how the Russians helped Trump. All right? We will listen to this, and then we will hear about the Russians.
Body Armor Edge is sports hydration with a boost of caffeine. With 100 milligrams of caffeine and 1,000 milligrams of electrolytes, Body Armor Edge is the sports drink to keep you going through.
Story. us be aware that while they preach the supremacy of the state, declare its omnipotence over individual man, and predict its eventual domination of all peoples on the earth, they are the focus of evil in the modern world.
This is genius. Putin declares a big portion of the Ukraine, of Ukraine. Putin declares it as independent. Oh, that's wonderful.
What I'm describing now is a plan and a hope for the long term. The march of freedom and democracy, which will leave Marxism-Leninism on the ash heap of history as it has left other tyrannies, which stifle the freedom and muzzle the self-expression of the people.
Very shrewd. Very capable. I have enormous respect for him. I've been criticized for saying that. No, I have enormous respect for him.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
If you want to look at somebody who's responsible for what's going on with Russia and Ukraine, just look at Joe Biden. But listen, we need to be saying to the Europeans, you've got to do more in your own defense.
This is Michael Cohen, and you're listening to the Mea Culpa podcast. The mangled Mussolini, Donald Trump, did what he did best on Tuesday evening, heaping praise upon Russian leader Vladimir Putin. This time, the twice-impeached ex-president lauded the authoritarian leader's geniusness invasion of Ukraine as very savvy.
I went in yesterday and there was a television screen and I said, this is genius. Putin declares a big portion of the Ukraine, of Ukraine. Putin declares it as independent. Oh, that's wonderful. So Putin is now saying it's independent, a large section of Ukraine. I said, how smart is that? And he's going to go in and be a peacekeeper. That's the strongest peace force. We could use that on our southern border. That's the strongest peace force I've ever seen. There were more army tanks than I've ever seen. They're going to keep peace all right.
Just ahead of President Joe Biden's announcement that he will impose a round of firm economic sanctions against Russia for deploying military troops into the Ukraine, Trump, who was impeached for withholding military aid as a way to pressure Kiev to meddle in the 2020 election, claimed on right-wing talk radio that this never would have happened under his presidency.
Think of it. Here's a guy who's very savvy. I know him very well. Very, very well. By the way, this never would have happened with us. Had I been in office, not even thinkable. This would never have happened. But here's a guy that says, you know, I'm going to declare a big portion of Ukraine independent. He used the word independent. And we're going to go out and we're going to go in and we're going to help keep peace. You got to say that's pretty savvy.
Though the former president and his loyalists continue to argue that Trump would have kept Putin from invading Ukraine, it was the then president's own team that said he looked incredibly weak after an obsequious Trump kowtow to Putin during the 2018 Helsinki summit. Furthermore, before leaving office, Trump spent years weakening NATO and advocating for U.S. troop drawdowns in Europe.
It was one of the most extraordinary moments between an American president and a Russian leader. Their meeting framed by Friday's Justice Department indictment of 12 Russian agents for election meddling and the judgment of U.S. intelligence agencies, including Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats, that Russia interfered. President Trump asked, who do you believe, President Putin or the U.S. intelligence community? His answer?
People came to me, Dan Coats came to me and some others. They said they think it's Russia. President Putin, he just said it's not Russia. I will say this, I don't see any reason why it would be.
And the president complimenting an offer from Putin. Instead of turning over the indicted Russian agents, Russian officials would question the agents themselves, with special counsel Bob Mueller present.
I have great confidence in my intelligence people, but I will tell you that President Putin was extremely strong and powerful in his denial today. And what he did is an incredible offer. He offered to have the people working on the case come and work with their investigators with respect to the 12 people. I think that's an incredible offer.
The former president often accuses his enemies falsely of treason, but his own giddy rush to side with a foreign leader who is proving to be an enemy of the United States and the West is shocking even by Trump's shameless standards. Politics, it was said, used to end at the American border. Well, not anymore.
I think it's
deeply disturbing for the former president to bandwagon and to cheerlead for the world's probably most belligerent authoritarian and an enemy of the United States that if he could, if he thought he could get away with it, would eliminate the United States in its entirety. This is the kind of person that we're dealing with. And this is who the president, the former president of the United States chooses to support. And Tucker Carlson is like the most obsequious, absurd caricature of a, you know, of an entertainer that's doing anything and everything he can to kind of fluff up his ratings. So it's hard for me to take it seriously.
Trump also sent an unmistakable message to Republicans who are already playing into Putin's hands by branding the current president as weak. That siding with a U.S. foe is the way into the ex-president's affections ahead of this year's midterm primaries. Listening to these mini-me's bloviate about Putin is nauseating. Worse, though, is the blatant hypocrisy of these people accusing Biden of being weak and appeasing Putin.
Tonight, Republicans are uniting against President Joe Biden and siding with a foreign autocrat, Vladimir Putin, as he is invading a sovereign and peaceful country. That in and of itself should be enough for all Americans to unite against Putin, but that is not what's happening.
Very shrewd. Very capable. I have enormous respect for him. I've been criticized for saying that. No, I have enormous respect for him. He was also an interlocutor that was always well-informed and deeply clear about what Russian interests were. I appreciated that. It required the same from us, from me, from my team. We had to be equally prepared and equally protective of the interests that matter to the United States. He is very savvy, very shrewd.
I think it's ridiculous that we're focused on this border in Ukraine. I got to be honest with you, I don't really care what happens to Ukraine one way or another. I do care about the fact that in my community right now, the leading cause of death among 18 to 45-year-olds is Mexican fentanyl that's coming across the southern border. I'm sick of Joe Biden focusing on the border.
And in New York, a Republican candidate for Congress is speaking positively about the Russian autocrat, tweeting, quote, Putin protects the church, tradition, and Russian culture to an extent that globalists cannot accept. He added that we deal with far worse governments regularly.
We've not seen anything just yet. This war that's about to unfold is going to have tens of thousands of casualties. We've not witnessed anything like this. When he conducted his campaign against Chechnya, thousands died. But that was, we were distracted, we weren't paying attention, we weren't as connected. This is going to be played all over every screen there is. And the Republicans that have been pandering and catering to Donald Trump and to Vladimir Putin are going to own this.
If it all seems insane, even by Trump's standards, it's because it is insane. What comes next will be the inevitable attempt by Fox News, Trump's official propaganda arm, to clean up his statements. They will say that Trump was trolling the media, just like he was trolling the press that time he suggested we inject ourselves with bleach. Well, here's the thing. Trump wasn't fucking trolling anybody. That would suggest he has a sense of humor, which we all know he doesn't. There's simply no governor between his brain and his mouth. What he thinks, he says. And he meant what he said. The man unabashedly loves Vladimir Putin. He wishes he could send the U.S. Army into Mexico.
Your problem here, which is that the kind of bipartisanship that we once counted on during the Cold War and afterward just isn't there anymore. And that Putin has to notice that. I mean, he has an entire political party that tends to agree with Donald Trump, that thinks, you know, he is a genius and that he's, pretty popular within that party. It's something he clearly has to take into account, and it works in his favor.
There's also the possibility, which I wouldn't put past Trump, that he said what he said to change the press narrative around the fact that he could be mere weeks away from an indictment. Every time he needs to raise his visibility, change the subject, or respond to an attack, Trump says something insane and the cycle starts anew. His strategy is to shock the media system by being outrageous, by being offensive, by being fucking provocative. This used to be the domain of his Twitter feed, which was a nonstop stream of invective and a peek into the mind of Donald Trump and his litany of grievances. But absent his platform and myriad of investigations coming his way, Trump desperately needed everyone to change the channel. And fucking presto, Ukraine, Putin, and away we go. It will ultimately prove to be Pyrrhic victory in that what came out of his mouth is so out of bounds and so fucking inflammatory and counter to decades of GOP precedent that he risks further dividing the Republican Party. But what does he care? It's always about Trump. Everyone else can go fuck themselves. My gut says that something far more sinister is happening. And Trump's desire to both praise Putin while changing the narrative around his own troubles plays into a larger obsession that the far right has with authoritarian leaders.
And this kind of weird fanboying for Vladimir Putin, who they think, I think they see as kind of the leader of a white Christian Europe, which is a fantasy, really. It's a kind of a GOP wish casting. It's not just criticism of Biden. It's coupled to this obvious admiration for a Russian dictator.
Shortly after the White House announced the first wave of sanctions against Russia for troops entering eastern Ukraine in a move described by President Biden as the beginning of an invasion, Tucker Carlson had a question for Americans. Why do you hate Russian President Vladimir Putin? But even with the Ukraine conflict and Russia's interference in the 2016 U.S. presidential election, the Fox News host described the tension in the region as merely a border dispute and wondered why Americans should despise the Russian president.
Since the day that Donald Trump became president, Democrats in Washington have told you you have a patriotic duty to hate Vladimir Putin. It's not a suggestion, it's a mandate. Anything less than hatred for Putin is treason. It might be worth asking yourself, since it is getting pretty serious, what is this really about? Why do I hate Putin so much? Has Putin ever called me a racist? Has he threatened to get me fired for disagreeing with him? Has he shipped every middle-class job in my town to Russia? Did he manufacture a worldwide pandemic that wrecked my business and kept me indoors for 2 years?
Carlson has told his viewers that there is no reason the United States should assist Ukraine in its fight against Russia and has recently doubled down on his support of Putin. The Fox News host, who acknowledged that he's attempting to interview Putin, said this week that it was not treason, it is not un-American to support Putin. It's the whole point of America, he said on Monday. Throughout his 5.5 years as a candidate and then president, Donald Trump made a habit of treating Putin like his best friend and long-lost brother. It was strangely over-the-top and uncomfortable to watch. Most of the time, you just shake your head and think, why is he doing that? And the GOP response, as with many of Trump's more idiotic statements, was to simply shrug it off and pretend like it never happened.
An extraordinary moment where you do have, Vladimir Putin's disinformation being channeled through American politics. And again, you could dismiss these voices, except that, look, Vladimir Putin has the measure of Donald Trump. Remember, he stood next to him in Helsinki, where Donald Trump actually sided with Vladimir Putin over his own government, has weakened NATO, was willing to shake down the government of Ukraine. Keep in mind, all of those things that have happened. And now you hear all of these voices that Vladimir Putin has to know are close to this MAGA world, who are taking his side, who are, smearing Ukraine and Ukrainian officials, and providing justifications for what Vladimir Putin is doing. So Vladimir Putin's mind, he sees a weakened United States, he sees his disinformation out there, and you have to ask whether or not he thinks that the West will blink, and whether or not, if Donald Trump comes back to the White House, that he will achieve a triumph beyond his wildest imaginings of a few years ago.
The result? With Russia now queuing up one of the biggest military confrontations in Europe in decades, Trump's Putin love has crept even more into the conservative mainstream and has gone well beyond merely suggesting that Putin is one tough cookie. It has often involved suggesting that he's not really a foe at all, or even that his invasion of Ukraine is justified or is somehow our fault. With it comes dismissals of Putin's human rights abuses and the Russian geopolitical threat that top Republicans assured us as recently as a decade ago was unparalleled. And now for the main event. Trump's Russia posture in his defense of Vladimir Putin amounts to gaslighting on an industrial scale. It's something we have seen from Trump and his GOP allies, not just when it comes to Putin and Russia, but also in terms of Trump's big lie and what happened on January 6th.
Okay, now, I want to get this other stuff in. We won't have time, so I'm not going to play the second portion of that. But I want, that was the, that the first one was, and this one was the Donald Trump scenario, also including the Jeannie Trump, and now, which came out last night. I want to play, we had the other big story was, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson that we need to talk about. Can you believe these people are so racist? You know, and it's not about Ketanji Brown Jackson. I don't know what his name. Ketanji Jackson Brown, I should say. When I say that, I don't know. Anyway, okay, let me plug this in so you can hear me correctly. Okay. Judge Ketanji Jackson Brown hearing. We need to hear something about this. And the one thing I want, after, I don't want to play any of the racist stuff. I want to play what Cory Booker, which I think was fabulous, where he, when it was his turn to speak about Judge Brown, which brought people to tears. So I want to play that.
Judge, after me, only five to go. But sit back for a second, because I don't have questions right away. I actually have a number of things I just want to say, because this has been not a surprise, given the history that we all know, not a surprise, but perhaps a little bit of a disappointment, some of the things that have been said in this hearing. The way you have dealt with some of these things, that's why you are a judge and I am a politician, because you have sat with grit and grace and have shown us just extraordinary demeanor during the times where people were saying things to you that are actually out of the norm. I had to go up dais to ask some of my more senior colleagues about the, what I feel like is a dangerous precedent. People are taking 1,000 cases you've been over, is that right? I'm sorry, I said you wouldn't ask you questions, but just give me a...
Something like that.
Something like that. And from what I understand is that these cases are often take days, weeks, sometimes months, right?
To decide in a case?
Yeah. There's a trial sometimes. And the folks are taking any of those cases and just trying to pick pieces out. And so my colleague, Senator Hawley, has been doing this all into the lead-up and saying things, tweeting things, that I think that a lot of us, when I was just trying to get some advice here, is this is what the new standard is going to be. That any judge coming before us that has ever chosen outside of the sentencing guidelines, below the sentencing guidelines, we're creating this environment now where I could make myself the hero of people who have been victims of some horrible crime and suddenly put whatever judge I want on the defensive by trying to drag out little bits when they have no context to the case. None of the facts. They're seeking to exploit the complexities of a criminal justice system, the reason why we have a third branch of government. I feel bad that there was a judge mentioned by name in this hearing that's from Senator Hawley's state. What is that judge going to think next time they have a complicated sexual abuse case that comes before them, and they know that they could possibly be called out if they go below the sentencing guidelines, which I showed you yesterday in my lack of chart. If you remember, I was uncharted. But that you are deciding completely in the norm. 70%+ in many states of people are doing just like you did. But I'm a Democratic senator. I've never quoted from this very well-respected conservative periodical. This is the National Review. Very well-respected. They're not necessarily something I agree with all the time. But here's what the National Review, this is the title. Senator Hawley's disingenuous attack against Judge Jackson's record on child pornography. Let's read the first paragraph. I would oppose Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson because of her judicial philosophy for the reasons I outlined last week. I addressed that in a separate post. For now, I want to discuss the claim by Senator Josh Hawley that Judge Jackson is appallingly soft on child pornography offenders. This is the kicker here. The allegations appear meritless to the point of demagoguery. I got letters from leaders of victims' rights groups, survivors of assault, all saying sort of the same thing with the National Review. Feel proud about yourself. You brought together right and left in this calling out of people that will sit up here and try to pull out from cases and try to put themselves in a position where they're the defenders of our children. To a person who has children, to a person whose family goes out in the streets and defends children. I mean, this is a new low. And what's especially surprising about this is it didn't happen last year. You were put on a court that I'm told is considered like the second most powerful court in our land. And you were passed with bipartisan support. Nobody brought it up then. Did they not do their homework? Were they lax? Did they make a mistake? I wonder, as they ask you the question, do you regret? I wonder if they regret that they didn't bring that out. No. Why? Because it was an allegation that is meritless to the point of demagoguery. You are, I don't mean this in any way, because if anybody called me average, I would be upset, but you are a mainstream judge. Your sentencing, I've looked at the data, falls in the mainstream on everything from child sexual assault to all the other issues that people are trying to bring up. Some of these things are being cast at you that you called George Bush a war criminal? Come on, that is painful. Especially because, as you said, the brief change, these are names that you have to put in. And we're talking about a real issue that goes to the core of our values, torture. Barack Obama was named once Bush left office. There is an absurdity to this that is, it is almost comical if it was not so dangerous. Because the next time a judge comes before us on the right or the left that has a body of work like you do, gosh, one of the, some performance artists on our side could pull out one of the cases where they were below the sentencing guidelines, say, for example, was on something like as horrific as rape that we all agree is horrific. And they could suddenly put themselves as a defense. How dare we put someone who's soft on crime? Well, are you soft on crime? God bless America. I got this great text. I've become really good friends with the folks at the FOP for my negotiations. And this was my favorite text. You all got to get this. I think my brother Kennedy might get a kick out of this. He goes, things that are uncountable, stars in the sky, grains of sand on the beach, and the number of times Democrats will mention that the FOP endorsed Judge Jackson in this hearing. But let me mention it again. Just in case my people say you're rough on crime, folks, really want to try to make that stick. You were endorsed by the largest organization of rank-and-file police officers. You were endorsed by the bosses, the largest organization of chiefs of police. And you were endorsed by Noble, who I hope people find out more about that organization. You got uncles that are officers. You got a brother, not just an officer, who went to serve after 9/11. Your family's not soft on terrorism. He went out there to capture and kill and defend this country from terrorists.
I actually sit back here and finding this astonishing, but then I do my homework. I love that my colleague brought up Constance Baker Motley. You know, when she was getting to the floor of the Senate, they were trying to stop her with outrageous accusations. You know what the accusation was back then? She was a communist. Dragging up stories, trying to throw anything that they might stick, but this is what you and I know. Any one of us senators could yell as loud as we want that Venus can't return a sir. We could yell as loud as we want that Beyonce can't sing. We could yell as much as we want that astronaut Mae Jemison didn't go all that high. But you know what? They got nothing to prove. As it says in the Bible, let the work I've done speak for me. Well, you have spoken. You started speaking as a little girl, watching that man right there try to raise a family and study law while your mama supported everybody. You spoke in high school when you started distinguishing yourself. And you know what you said when they told you you couldn't go to Harvard? Watch me. I went to law school. I didn't serve on the law review. You did. I didn't clerk at every level of the federal court. You clerked for a Supreme Court justice, one widely respected on both sides, which really shaped you. You left there and you went to private practice, and you know what you found? This is what you told me. That you had those tough choices that working moms have to make, the demands of a private law firm, raising your kids. It just didn't add up. You went before this Senate 3 times in a bipartisan manner. God bless America. We don't do that much stuff bipartisan around here. You went to become a public defender because you wanted to understand all aspects of the law. Who does that? We live in a society that's very materialistic sometimes, very, very consumeristic. You went to, do people become public defenders for the money? No. Your family and you speak to service, service, service. And I'm telling you right now, I'm not letting anybody in the Senate steal my joy. I told you this at the beginning. I'm embarrassed. It happened earlier today. I just look at you and I start getting full of emotion. I'm jogging this morning and I'm at the end of the block I live on. And I get terrified because I put my music on loud when I'm jogging, trying to block out the noise of the heart attack I'm having. And this woman comes up on me, practically tackles me, an African-American woman. And the look on her eyes, she just wanted to touch me because I'm sitting so close to you. And tell me what it meant to her to watch you sitting where you're sitting. And you did not get there because of some left-wing agenda? You didn't get here because of some dark money groups? You got here how every black woman in America who's gotten anywhere has done. By being, like Ginger Rogers said, I did everything Fred Astaire did, but backwards in heels. And so I'm just sitting here saying nobody's stealing my joy. Nobody's going to make me angry, especially not people that are called in a conservative magazine demagogic for what they're bringing up that just doesn't hold water. I'm not going to let my joy be stolen because I know you and I, we appreciate something that we get that a lot of my colleagues don't. I know Tim Scott does. When I first came to this place, I was the 4th black person ever popularly elected to the United States Senate. And I still remember a lot of mixed people, white folks, black folks work here, but at night when people are in line to come in to clean this place, the percentage of minorities shift a lot. And so I'm walking here, first week I'm here, and somebody who's been here for decades doing the urgent work of the Senate, but it's the unglamorous work that goes on no matter who's in offices, the guy comes up to me, all he wants to say I can tell is, I'm so happy you're here. But he comes up and he can't get the words out. And this man, my elder, starts crying. And I just hugged him, and he just kept telling me, it is so good to see you here. It's so good to see you here. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I love my brother, Tim Scott. We could write a dissertation on our disagreements. He gave the best speech on race. I wish I could have given a good of a speech. But talking to the challenges and indignities that are still faced. And you're here. I was in the White House with my Democratic colleagues, and I'm in my joy. I can't help it. And the president's asking our advice, who should we nominate and whatever. And I look at Kamala, and we have a knowing glance, which we've had for years when she and I used to sit on this end of this committee at times. And then I try to get out to the president what it means. What it means. And I want to tell you, when I look at you, this is why I get emotional. I'm sorry, you're a person that is so much more than your race and gender. You're a Christian, you're a mom, you're an intellect, you love books, but for me, I'm sorry, it's hard for me not to look at you and not see my mom, not to see my cousins, one of them who had to come here and sit behind you. She had to have your back. I see my ancestors and yours. Nobody's going to steal the joy of that woman in the street or the calls that I'm getting or the texts. Nobody's going to steal that joy. You have earned this spot. You are worthy. You are a great American. Your hero is Constance Baker Motley. Mine, she has sat on my desk for my offices that I've held. She's my icon of America. Her name is Harriet Tubman. There is a love in this country that is extraordinary. You admitted it about your parents. They loved this nation, even though there were laws preventing them from getting together. When they were loving, there were laws in this country that would have prevented you from marrying your husband. It wasn't that long ago. It was last generation. But they didn't stop loving this country, even though this country didn't love them back. And what were the words of your heroes and mine? What did Constance Baker Motley do? Did she, this country that she saw insult and injuries, when she came out of law school, law firms wouldn't even hire her because she was a woman. Did she become bitter? Did she try to create a revolution? No, she used the very constitution of this nation. She loved it so much, she wanted America to be America. As Langston Hughes wrote, oh, let America be America again. The land that never has been yet, but yet must be the land where everyone is free. Oh, yes, I say it plain. America never was America to me, but I swear this oath, America will be. That is the story of how you got to this desk. You and I and everyone here, generations of folk who came here and said, America, I'm Irish, you may say, no, Irish or dogs need to apply, but I'm going to show this country that I can be free here. I can make this country love me as much as I love it. Chinese Americans first forced into mere slave labor, building our railroads, connecting our country, saw the ugliest of America, but they were going to build their home here and say, America, you may not love me yet, but I'm going to make this nation live up to its promise and hope. LGBTQ Americans, from Stonewall women to Seneca, hidden figures who didn't even get their play until some Hollywood movie finally talked about them and how they were critical for us defying gravity. All of these people loved America. And so you faced insults here that were shocking to me. Well, actually not shocking. But you are here because of that kind of love. And nobody's taken this away from me. So you got five more folk to go through. Five more of us. And then you can sit back and let us have all the debates. And I'm going to tell you, it's going to be a well-charted Senate floor because it's not going to stop. They're going to accuse you of this and that. Heck, in honor of your person who shares your birthday, you might be called a communist. But don't worry, my sister. Don't worry. God has got you. And how do I know that? Because you're here. And I know what it's taken for you to sit in that seat. Harriet Tubman is one of my heroes because the more I read about this person, the more, I mean, she was viciously beaten. Her whole life she used to fall into spells, cracked skull. She faced starvation, chased by dogs. And when she got to freedom, what did she do? Did she rest? No, she went back. Again and again and again. The sky was full of stars. But she found one that was a harbinger of hope for better days, not just for her and those people that were enslaved, but a harbinger of hope for this country. And she never gave up on America. She fought in the, led troops in the Civil War. She was involved in the suffrage movement. And as I came back from my run, after being near assaulted by someone on the street, I thought about her and how she looked up. She kept looking up. No matter what they did to her, she never stopped looking up. And that star, it was a harbinger of hope. Today, you're my star. You are my harbinger of hope. This country is getting better and better and better. And when that final vote happens, and you ascend onto the highest court in the land, I'm going to rejoice. And I'm going to tell you right now, the greatest country in the world, the United States of America, will be better because of you. Thank you. Judge, after me, only five to go. But sit back for a second, because I don't have questions right away. I actually have a number of things I just want to say, because
I hope you heard me, because I didn't have the button pressed, so I don't know if everybody heard me, but that was the story, what Cory Booker said about Ketanji Brown Jackson, who will be the next Supreme Court justice and the first black female Supreme Court justice. That would have been my number one, I guess number one issue next to almost having World War III in Ukraine. But now it's been decided today sometime. I don't know. We heard about it today sometime that the president is going to make a very dramatic speech on the war in Ukraine. So I don't know what time today, but it's now 4:30 here. So we just have to figure out what he's trying to say and what he's going to say. So we went full circle. We went around the Jeannie Thomas doohickey to see what she was trying to spread to her. Her best friend, as she words it in her text message to Mark Meadows, that she told her best friend about it. And you know, she calls, people know that they call each other Thomas and Jeannie Thomas. They call each other best friends. So we're going to see how that's going to ride over, if that can be brought up to the table somewhere where we can get him the hell out of there. I want to play something that was very relevant about what's going to go down in the next 12 days. This is what they're saying. The next 12 days is going to be the push-pull on this Ukraine problem, whether we're going to have war or not. Now, this is what Ari Melber has brought up. I want you to listen to this.
Here's what's going on right now on the world stage. Some of the most powerful leaders of Western democracies are at this emergency NATO summit meeting. It's a show of forced unity and concern against how Vladimir Putin continues to run these attacks and this war against Ukraine. This realignment against Russia, in many ways, was avoidable. It's wrought by Putin's decision to launch a war that's now killed thousands and displaced over 3 million. This is a war that Putin started. That's a fact. Many experts say that while the Ukrainian resistance continues to be effective, the ending of this war will likely be up to Putin in many ways. And that brings us to our special report for you right now. We recently charted Ukrainian President Zelensky's unusual path to power and how that created a framework for him to then lead this resistance in ways that have caught many by surprise, as one of our guests remarked on earlier tonight. Now we turn to a report on the making of Vladimir Putin, a very different man and a different adversary, a man whom much of the Western world still is struggling to understand and constrain as he leads this largest land war in Europe since World War II. This reporting, which draws on many different sources, this collective understanding of this man, it matters. Sadly, it is a matter of security and an existential issue for so many in the region. Putin is an authoritarian. His reign has now spanned 5 U.S. presidents. So to understand where he began, he first took power in 2000, tapped by Kremlin insiders to replace Boris Yeltsin after Putin's own 16 years of service as a KGB agent.
Not long ago, I had about a 20-minute phone conversation with President Boris Yeltsin, who today ends his historic tenure as Russia's democratically elected president.
In Moscow, preliminary results of the presidential elections have been announced. According to the data from the Central Election Commission, Vladimir Putin has been elected president of Russia.
Putin deployed his own government background and relationships to actually get installed as Yeltsin's successor, which allowed him to then run for the results you just saw as kind of a new incumbent with connected insiders and forces behind Putin, who immediately used the power of official state TV to enhance his profile, aiming to win him more than 50% of the votes cast. As the Times reported, that was before the 2000 election. Putin came up decidedly through that old system. And any way that he has updated Russian governing has typically focused on modernizing authoritarian tactics for the new age we live in, not to share power or freedom or engage meaningfully in democracy. Stalin infamously purged and killed people and then would literally have the state photographs doctored to make it as if they never existed. Photography itself, a kind of information weapon. Putin deployed more modern propaganda from the cyber meddling and online influence campaigns that occurred in the United States that we may all remember from 2016 and in Europe right now, to carefully stage propaganda and grandiose images that try to cast Russia and thus Putin as still a piece of some kind of Soviet-era dominant power. That's why Putin experts say he invests so much in these grand international events, you may recall, because they both enhance his perceived power and try to launder and cover for his authoritarianism. It's widely reported that Putin obsessed over getting the 2014 Olympics to Russia, even claiming that he would end Russian attacks on civil rights and censorship to get his much-needed international approval. Those were actually the most expensive games to date, $50 billion and counting, and he terrorized staff to pull it off. One project manager fled the country after being fired and being warned of retribution by Putin. That manager later said he was poisoned with mercury. Now, Putin got those Olympics. In fact, he was back at it making a bid to host the 2020 World Expo, a pitch so important, again, because he clearly cares about some of the world's opinions, that this is one of the only times Mr. Putin's ever been seen speaking English in public.
Russia has a long and rich experience of participation in the World Expo movement. We proudly submit our bid to host World Expo 2020 in Yekaterinburg.
That's how bad he wanted. That was years out. You can see him laboring to make the case in English, and it did not work. The expo went to the UAE. Just as Putin sought the image and luster of international credibility to try to blunt any edges of his actual autocratic moves, he has constantly tried to get American presidents to see him and treat him as something other than a dictator and adversary.
It's very important for the future that we continue to work together.
He just laid out a vision. I think it's very sincere. I think it's innovative. I think it's strategic.
We had excellent discussions with the President yesterday. I am aware of not only the extraordinary work that you've done on behalf of the Russian people.
We've had great meetings. We've had a very, very good relationship.
Donald Trump's warmth towards Putin is well known, and it may be complicated, as we've reported. But what's actually telling about Putin's abilities is that all of this predates Donald Trump's unusual presidency. The ex-KGB officer has proven pretty effective at personal diplomacy, given the hand he's playing. He even drew one of the perhaps most odd compliments an American president has ever given any Russian leader when George W. Bush talked about Putin's soul, which was later mocked by Hillary Clinton.
I found it to be very straightforward and trustworthy. We had a very good dialogue. I was able to get a sense of his soul, a man deeply committed to his country and the best interests of his country.
Well, this is the president that looked in the soul of Putin, and I could have told him he was a KGB agent. By definition, he doesn't have a soul. I mean, this is a waste of time, right?
A waste of time, but one that the United States and its diplomats have to contend with. Putin has also found ways to try to play administrations off each other. He does not practice democracy at home, but he has some understanding of the politics of a democracy. By the time Obama tapped Clinton as his Secretary of State, she was trying her own version of Russian outreach, meeting with Putin's top diplomat, Sergei Lavrov, to present, remember this, a giant reset button that was supposed to symbolize a jumpstart and reset for these two countries' relationship.
We want to reset our relationship.
Let's do it together.
So we will do it together, okay?
Thank you very much.
You are very welcome.
That's the warmth of diplomacy. Many diplomats try it. We should note the diplomat you see there on the Russian side, though, Lavrov, is the same one Trump would later host in the Oval Office after firing James Comey over the Russia probe. So things got even trickier. Lavrov's still in that post today, pushing Putin's global agenda. As for Clinton, well, she concluded Putin was getting more out of those types of gestures than the United States. And by 2013, she says she was counseling Obama against flattering Putin with high-level attention. Decline his invitation for a presidential summit, she said. It was 2 years later that President Obama's hardcore glare at Putin at a UN meeting got some notice around the world. Many nations were soon glaring at Russia when it made that first incursion into Ukraine, which was a year later, a year after that photo with Obama in 2014. The Times reported how Putin reclaimed Crimea for Russia and bitterly denounced the West along the way. Now, that move was not a full-scale war to formally topple the government, but it was a new line crossed. It showed what Putin was doing, feeling strong, unchallenged at home, and bent on defying even the appeals to his own interests from a much more powerful country, the United States. As Obama put it, why disrupt Ukraine when doing so would mean Western sanctions? There's no single confirmed answer, only the reality that those partial sanctions back then did not slow Putin down. Today is different. He faces crippling, massive, enduring sanctions for what is a full-scale war. Another answer to the question of what Putin was thinking then and now is that his strategy is to take great risks or costs because he is hell-bent on a Russian resurgence. He's long viewed the Soviet collapse as a kind of tragedy. He called it the geopolitical catastrophe of the century. And he's pushed the idea that Russia must counter the West, and specifically NATO, which he claims he views as a provocation that's outlasted its Cold War era use. So that's another answer if you think this is all consistent foreign policy. A third possibility is that Putin thinks Ukraine must just be a part of Russia, that this is Ukraine-specific. Last year, he wrote an essay asserting true sovereignty of Ukraine is possible only in partnership with Russia. We are one people. That's kind of like how he once claimed that his rule of Russia would follow a path away from harmful communism and towards being, well, something that he lies about, towards being, he claimed, a democracy.
Only an effective and democratic state can uphold civic, political, and economic freedom. We have developed a democratic political system. The multi-party system is a reality now. Russians can elect their president, the deputies of the state Duma, governors, and local governments.
A younger Putin claiming that it's a democracy, trying to argue that in key ways Russia is like the West. But Putin's Russia only has the trick and trappings of a fake democracy as a shell around his dictatorship. In 2020, Putin gave himself a pass to stay in power another 14 years. He unilaterally canceled any limits in the Constitution. That was 2 years after he publicly said he would not do that. This is what his authoritarianism looks like, and it creates a loop of repression and disinformation and confusion that strengthens the power of the autocrat. So Putin can create the perception today that initially, when the internet first burst on the scene, might have seemed like a difficult task. How would you get people to think your dictatorship's a democracy or the war you started isn't even happening? But of course, as you may have noticed from some of the coverage in the last month, Vladimir Putin censors huge parts of the internet. He suppresses criticism and war coverage to the point that many Russians do incorrectly think there is no aggressive or unilateral war that Russia started in Ukraine. For many experts who've charted Putin over the years, it's clear that sometimes he will talk directly about his goals. I quoted some of his writings, for example, about Ukraine. That other times he lies. And the difficulty will be figuring out what he is up to at any given time.
We democratized our electoral system in a serious manner.
I will continue to work actively, openly, and honestly.
If you're weak, there will be always someone who would like to come over or fly over.
We must look to the future of our great motherland strategically.
I don't think the Ukrainian people is in any way unfriendly. No, we are one single entity. Now, the leadership of Ukraine, that's an altogether different matter.
Take it all in from where he started and all the different things he says, claims, and does. And the bad news is how devastating Putin's goals are and how effective he has been over the years as he's accrued even more power and dealt with other leaders and countries that are stronger than him militarily and economically. On the other hand, you take it all together and experts say there are some constructive points here because this is a person who does respond to some of the world's stated values, who does respond to external pressure, who has felt the need to at least claim that he follows democracy even when he doesn't, or that he'll stop censoring even when he won't. So something worked there up to a point. This is a person subject to self-interest, and that can be used against him, perhaps not only for the benefit of Ukraine, but for the benefit of many people stuck being ruled by Vladimir Putin inside Russia as well. That's our special report drawing on sources and archives, but we turn now to someone who knows far more than most about this very individual. Return to the program, former Ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul. Welcome back, sir.
Thanks, Ari, and fantastic piece, tremendous piece. And I was at several of those meetings that you just showed over the course of my time working for the Obama administration.
Well, thank you, and let's start there. What you see over that arc of time of what he's become, how he operates, and what, if anything, that provides the West for constraining him?
Well, a couple of things I'd underscore that were in your piece. Number one, he was an accidental president. He was chosen by Boris Yeltsin, a democratically elected president. He blessed him. He made him the acting president on the first day of the millennium and then got him elected. It was ratified by the people, but he wasn't a populist figure. He wasn't an opposition figure, too, as your piece rightly pointed out. He was not a communist. He was not with the nationalists. He was part of the system. He was an opportunist until he became president. Number two, another piece of your reporting, I think is really important for people to understand. It's not a coincidence, in my view, that as Putin became more autocratic at home, he became more antagonistic to the democratic West. And if you think about it, it makes sense, right? If you're an autocrat, you're threatened by democratic countries. And two, if you're an autocrat, you need an argument for legitimacy. Xi Jinping, by the way, he has economic growth, right? That's his deal with the Chinese people. For Putin, it's always been the West is out to get us. They're out to get us, and that's why we need to be vigilant. And if you look at the way he argues about why he invaded Ukraine today, it's all about Nazis, right? Think about how crazy that is. It's the Nazis leading Ukraine that are out to get us, supported by the United States of America. It's the necessity to have this outside enemy as a way to legitimate your autocracy back home.
Mm. When you see him seeking the international approval, the grand events, does that offer any clues for what the West can do now?
That's a really hard question, and my answer is probably not. And I think that's another really important part of your piece. The Vladimir Putin that became president in 2000, the Vladimir Putin that I first met in 1991, by the way, so I met him a long, long time ago, has changed over these decades. Initially, he wanted the respect from the West. He valued that his relationship with President Bush in particular that you showed, that was very valuable to him. And after September 11th, they bonded over this global fight against terrorism, right? But over time, he's become more paranoid. And he's become more paranoid because of democratic breakthroughs. So Georgia 2003, the Orange Revolution in Ukraine in 2004, Arab Spring 2011, massive mobilization in his own country against his regime in December 2011, in the spring of 2012, and then the Revolution of Dignity in Ukraine in 2014. All of those events, in his views, are masterminded by the West, by the KGB, by the deep state of the United States of America, overthrowing his allies and trying to overthrow him. So 20 years ago, I think he wanted to be part of the West. Today, I don't think he no longer cares about that. He's decided that's not part of his future. And therefore, that's the reason he only looks to one leader in the world today for respect and to develop a relationship, and that's Xi Jinping.
Okay, one person in the world he respects is Jinping Singh. Only one. Now, when you don't have any friends in the world, and you have somebody who supposedly is your friend, but can't outwardly help you, sneak around a little bit here and there. Well, we'll find out. And then they're going to be in trouble. They'll be in trouble. Do they want that? Well, I don't want to tell you. This has been we've heard Jeannie Thomas and her bullshit trying to overturn the U.S. government, and then Mark Meadows using Jesus Christ to help him overthrow the U.S. government constitution. Morning Joe is so right. That is so disgusting. This is your country. This is your country, but you are going to use and pray that Jesus Christ helps you overturn this government in the favor of the Russian government. And not even a government. An authoritarian state. Because we couldn't become an authoritarian state. That's right. That's what Trump wanted to become. An authoritarian state where he would have all controls of everything. This was, as I said, I've been saying this for over a year. The whole thing was when he got in office, Help me get in office and I will get rid of that damn NATO and you can have every single thing that you ever wanted, Putin. Make sure I get in there. And then for a little bit, you know, you give me a little bit of building in Moscow where I can have, make some money. You know, I can build a building there in downtown Moscow. People will come flocking over to... Hell no! No one was going to go to you. I mean, what was, this is how brain dead he is. After he overthrew and put in an authoritarian government in the United States, he thought that people would flock to him. Oh, because he's the president of this... Not president. He would be the hammer and nail in charge of the United States. I don't know if it would be called the United States anymore if he was in charge. It wouldn't be. United Federation, maybe. This man is such a thug, along with his friend, Thug Putin, Vladimir. But too bad they didn't, people in this country saw through that bullshit. They saw through that bullshit. They most certainly did. They saw through it. And he wasn't elected. And now, I'm going to be doing a lot more research and to find out what the hell is that guy Bragg, the DA in Manhattan, doing now. What is he doing now? I hope the daggone feds, the SDNY, is going to find something on him. That's what I hope. Because if he, hey, he let the two brightest attorneys in the country go, because he did not want to, Bragg did not want the DAs to charge Trump. This is what we're hearing. Hey, we don't know if this is just a come on to get this man in a weakened state. We don't know. All I know is what we know. And you know what? As the old saying goes, you don't know what you don't know. You don't know what you don't know. Rich people. What do you think about them? Well, let's hear something on rich people.
Donald Trump is a criminal level tax cheat. He is America's, our own American war criminal.
He should be sent to jail today.
Any way a person can lie and cheat and steal for his entire life, Donald Trump has.
Yeah. He just has to go to jail for a long time.
From analysts to former colleagues, people who know Donald Trump's conduct have long said he belongs in jail. The news tonight, Donald Trump is not heading towards indictment in New York, let alone jail. And since New York has the most advanced open criminal probe, legal experts say that means Donald Trump will probably never be indicted for anything he's done up to this moment that I'm speaking to you right now. The reasons matter. The new DA of New York, Alvin Bragg, just paused the entire criminal probe of Trump's finances. That was the successful investigation, which even won a Supreme Court case to get Trump's tax returns. It's the case of the highest profile indictments of Trump's business days, like the CFO, who still awaits trial on fraud-related charges. But now we know that is as far as this probe will go. After much speculation and a few leaks here and there, what's new right now is the first written on-the-record rebuke of Trump's allegedly criminal conduct in New York in his business by the top-line prosecutor who's been working this very case for years. That prosecutor got the tax returns, ran the grand jury probe, took what he calls damning evidence from many witnesses, and then concluded Trump is guilty of numerous felony violations.
The New York Times obtained the prosecutor's letter, which came when he resigned after the DA paused this case. And the prosecutor writes that the failure to indict Trump is a grave failure of justice itself. Now, that prosecutor clearly thought he was on some kind of path to charges under the previous DA, Cy Vance, who managed the vast majority of this probe. And that was a DA who had pursued some pretty high-profile cases, but was also known, quite frankly, to waffle. Indeed, if you watch this show, it might not be a surprise, because we reported last year that that DA, Cy Vance, had already punted on his prior probe of the same company, Trump Org, and he could do that again. He was criticized for following the path of many other prosecutors after the 08 financial crash, treating most bank's activities as something more akin to bad judgment than crime. And there are basically three doors here for how this probe ends, according to precedent. It could still end, like the DA's last Trump Org case, after much attention and drama, closed, without any charges. Now, Vance kept the probe going, but he left office without charging or clearing former President Trump. It was the biggest case in his office. So Vance basically punted on the most significant charging decision in the history of the American presidency. Now, that was not only a dodge, it also forced this very tough call on his new replacement, who would have less experience on the job or familiarity with the long-running probe. And someone we've spoken to on this program, you may recall, Alvin Bragg. Now, we follow the facts, we follow the people in power, and so I asked Alvin Bragg about this very case more than once. Within weeks of taking office, he even said he was following those facts to make a final decision about whether to indict Trump.
I led the team that held Trump and his children accountable for their misconduct with the Trump Foundation. So I go where the facts go.
But does that mean the door is open to the potential indictment?
Well, we are, obviously, as you know, it's open investigation, and we're going to go where the facts take us. I'm now obviously a new person looking at those facts as the final decision maker, and we're in the process of doing that.
They said they were in the process of doing that 2 months ago, and now we know they really were. But Bragg gave such a definitive no within weeks on the job that you have this prosecutor resigning in protest over the call. So think about where this leaves us. One DA scores a series of victories from the Supreme Court to indictments, only to punt on the big final call, the point to the whole thing, if you go to the top of the crime conspiracy as alleged or not. Another DA comes in and quickly decides not to indict, drawing this outrage resignation. Now, there may be valid evidentiary reasons that Bragg decided to hit pause. The line prosecutor thought otherwise. Clearly, that's what the letter's about. But prosecutors are well known for developing high confidence in the cases they themselves are building. Now, we know this case never found, at least according to public record, any unassailable inside witness who could flip. And we know something else. Donald Trump approaches his exaggerated financial estimates like a baby approaches spinach baby food, getting pieces of it on everyone involved in the process, to the point that everyone's a little dirty and no one can really say they're not a part of it. I use the baby analogy deliberately, but I mean it. The auditors, the lawyers, the IRS, the New York authorities, they've all had these numbers and financial estimates for a while. They're all kind of in on aspects of it. And does it mean that Donald Trump told the truth? His own auditors don't even say he told the truth. But it does mean his financial activities were hard to pin only on him. And none of this means there were never any legal consequences at all. The people jailed or indicted for their work for Trump include this same company's lawyer, its CFO, its longtime former lobbyist, who's gotten in trouble for more than one thing. But at the end of the day, the evidence shows Donald Trump did exploit the American legal system much as he exploited its political system. You don't always need more votes to win, it turns out. You can get away with a lot more if you're rich and powerful, as many people knew. And then, as every effective thug or gangster knows, you don't go to jail for everything you ever did. You only go to jail for something they can really prove.
Everything about it is appealing. Everything the traffic will allow. Nowhere could you get that happy feeling when you are stealing that extra bow. There's no people like show people. They smile when they are low. Yesterday they told you you would not go far. Dressing room, they hung a star. Let's go on with the show. The costumes, the scenery, the makeup, the props, the audience that lifts you when you're down. The headaches, the heartaches, the backaches, the flops, the sheriff who escorts you out of town. The opening when your heart beats like a drum. Closing when the customers don't come. There's no business like no business, like no business I know. You get word before the show has started that your favorite uncle died.